Tina Brown is with us once again. She is the editor of The Daily Beast and of Newsweek and a regular guest on this program. She comes by for a feature we call Word of Mouth. We talk about what she's been reading. Learn about it. Hi, Tina.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to talk with you. I think we last spoke right before the royal wedding, so you must have had a nice time.
We did. I mean, it was really an incredibly glorious day. I think it was one of the most fun things I've done recently.
And yet you managed to work in a little bit of reading since then. You've sent us some readings that will take us all the way through life here, from the beginning to the end. And let's begin at the beginning. There's a book called The Anti-Romantic Child. The author is Priscilla Gilman.
Indeed, it's a really a wonderful memoir by the mother of a child who turned out to be very, very different from the child that she'd always dreamed of. Priscilla Gilman is an academic. She was teaching classes on Wordsworth, and she'd always had this fantasy of, as all mothers do, of the kind of child that she would have, who would be kind of absolutely sort of like herself and very much a child she would recognize and so on. But it turns out that her child was different. Her son had something called hyperlexia, which is on the spectrum of autism and Asperger's. And he talks and talks and talks in this way that's very kind of stilted and tends to echo what he's heard. For instance, if you say to him, "Are you thirsty?" he might echo back, "Are you thirsty?" as opposed to, "I am thirsty." Mm. So there are issues like that, issues of eye contact, issues of not really being able to, it seems, understand and communicate exactly as other kids do in the way that things are put to him and so on.
Can I just mention, mm-hmm. it's excruciating to read her account, and you excerpt some of it in Newsweek here, her account of taking this 2.5-year-old to school for a kind of examination or interview to get into the school. And even though the kid is sitting there spelling out words at age 2.5 with like letters in front of him, Benjamin, Flapjack, Friday, he can spell. The teachers look at this kid and say that he's not behaving properly, and they deliver the mother the crushing news, there's something wrong with your child.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think one of the most poignant things in the book is when she says, one of the most painful things about these discoveries was they made me feel that all the things that I'd considered unique and special about Benji were instead uncontrollable manifestations of a disorder. He wasn't unusual. He was typical, ordinary, a classic case. He didn't have an interesting mind. He had faulty wiring. This was devastating to her because all these special things about him she thought were so special were in fact the symptoms of this disorder, hyperlexia. So the book really is about how she copes with this news and alters her understanding of what being a mother is going to be, while at the same time loving her child so much and understanding how she must now approach everything about him differently.
You have also sent us an article from a California literary review called The Three Penny Review. The title is On Being an Only Child. The author is Jeff Dyer.
Yeah, this is a wonderful piece. It's about growing up as an only child in Britain with parents who adored him, actually, but who were very poor, in fact, although he didn't see them as poor at the time. Everything about them they did was about economizing. And he's very funny about it, actually. I mean, they never had anything that wasn't kind of handmade. Like, you know, he says, "Clothes for my action man, my mum would make them. A Sabutio soccer pitch, she bought a piece of green baize and painted on the lines. We always bought the cheapest version of things. We hardly ever went on holiday." All of this kind of litany of things about his childhood he kind of accepted at the time, but he didn't really accept. And what became for him the abiding memory of his childhood was the long yawning afternoons when there was absolutely nothing to do, nothing. He talks about how in those days afternoons were so long. He played Monopoly with himself. He always was with himself. And yet, in some ways, of course, it also meant that having to sit there all day long and come up with something to amuse himself in the end define kind of the way he's living today, which is as a writer. He sits there all day at his computer trying to come up with something to amuse himself. He also, though, talks very amusingly about the reaction of him as he got older to that childhood. He said at a certain point he became a splurger and always had more than one chocolate bar. And it's touching at the end, too, because he goes to Oxford. He becomes, of course, brilliant as he sat there reading all the time. And he realizes that he and his parents have got to find some way to connect, because being an only child meant there was no sister or brother who could actually somehow help to bind this strange little threesome together. He somehow tried to reach out to his parents and make them understand a different world that he'd entered now, away from this world of absolutely reduced economy and so on. And there's a very touching moment when he surprises his mother, who was a dinner lady in a school, and they embrace and hug each other, and he tries to communicate a sense that there is a world beyond the world that they have.
So we've started at the beginning of life, and now we come to an article in Vanity Fair by Christopher Hitchens, who many people will know as a noted writer who's been suffering from cancer. What is he writing about now?
Well, this is an incredibly moving piece. Chris Hitchens is a very old friend of mine for, you know, the last 35, 40 years, really. And he talks about how having cancer of the throat has meant that, of course, he now has an attack on his vocal cords, which has, of course, taken away his voice. And Christopher Hitchens' voice was always one of his greatest gifts. You know, he speaks, he had a marvelously melodic and resonant voice that he used, of course, to great effect. And, of course, for him to lose this voice is absolutely a traumatic thing for him. But he also writes about how a voice is so important to a writer, literally. He says writers are always told they need to find their voice, but he himself as a writer was told once by a colleague, Simon Hoggart, that he ought to write more the way he talks. And I understand that, actually, because I do remember Christopher writing in a somewhat different way when he was younger, and how he actually genuinely did find his voice and became a very different kind of a literary journalist than he was in the early part of his career. So for him to lose that voice now as he battles with cancer, you know, has been absolutely a traumatic thing. He says deprivation of the ability to speak is more like an attack of impotence or the amputation of part of the personality. To a great degree, in public and private, I was my voice.
Can I mention, before he lost his voice, he gave a number of interviews to 60 Minutes on CBS. They were broadcast not so long ago, and he indicated in those interviews his greatest fear was losing the ability to write, that perhaps he would not have the energy or the focus, that he would have nothing more to say. At least you can think from the evidence of this Vanity Fair article that he's still writing and writing compellingly.
Well, I think he's become more and more compelling as a writer, actually, and the beautiful essay that he writes here about his voice is really one of the great things that he's written. And there's no doubt that not being able to speak probably has taken him further into himself to write a kind of emotionally pure kind of a writing that he really in the past might not have wanted to do. So it's made him a very personal writer in a way, which I can hardly say is a consolation because it isn't. But it is interesting how his prose has changed as the illness has taken hold.
The feature is called Word of Mouth. We hear from Tina Brown of The Daily Beast and Newsweek. Tina, thanks as always.
Thank you.